Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are really thrilled to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
We are going to be exploring a world that is essentially hiding in plain sight. I mean, we are synthesizing a really specialized stack of clinical sources today.
We've got excerpts from Cobbett, the Lewis texts.
Right, some comprehensive maternal nursing guides, and several clinical images too, which give us a frontline visual of what this actually looks like.
Which is incredibly helpful because when you think about eating, your mind goes to the sensory
It's a
experience.
taste, chewing.
Exactly. The whole gastrointestinal tract is this perfectly calibrated biological machine. But when that natural pathway is compromised, medical science has to step in.
They have to engineer a completely new route. And our mission for this deep dive is to demystify that hidden, highly engineered world of long-term feeding tubes, these artificial lifelines that completely bypass our normal eating mechanisms.
It's remarkable technology.
Yeah, okay, let's unpack this. Because, you might casually think of a feeding tube as just simple medical plumbing.
A lot of people do.
Yeah, but the precise placement, the fluid dynamics, the daily maintenance, it is an incredible feat of medical engineering.
To really grasp the scale of it, we should probably establish the baseline. Like, when do doctors actually make this call?
Right, because they don't bypass the mouth lightly. The clinical guidelines have a very specific threshold.
It's for when a patient needs enteral nutrition for a long time. The literature usually defines that as greater than 4 to 6 weeks.
And they can't tolerate a nasoenteric tube, that temporary tube running down the nose and into the stomach.
Right. But the massive prerequisite here is that the patient's underlying gastrointestinal tract has to be intact.
Unobstructed.
Exactly. The physiological machinery of the stomach and intestines still works. It's just a delivery problem.
Like an anatomical obstruction in the esophagus,
Hmm.
a stricture or a malignancy where food physically cannot reach the stomach.
Or the swallowing mechanism is fundamentally unsafe. Say, due to a severe neurological condition like ALS or a stroke, the medical team basically has to create a new front door.
Which brings us to the most common entryways. Gastrostomy tubes, which go into the stomach, and jejunostomy tubes, which go into the small intestine.
Let's start with the G-tubes, or PEG tubes as they're widely known.
Right. PEG stands for percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy, which is just the surgical approach they use to place it from the inside out using an endoscope.
Straight through the abdominal wall and into the stomach.
And the surgical engineering is fascinating because the stomach is a free-moving organ, right? So the surgeon has to securely anchor the stomach wall to the peritoneum, the inner lining of the abdominal cavity.
Using a tight purse-string suture. That prevents any gastric contents from spilling out into the open abdominal space.
Which would be catastrophic. And
Yeah.
because the stomach is designed as this robust holding tank, G-tubes can be pretty substantial. The guidelines say they range from 12 to 30 French in size.
To put that in perspective for you, a 12 French tube is roughly the thickness of a standard smartphone charging cable.
While a 30 French tube is much thicker, it's closer to the diameter of a standard Sharpie marker, which allows for those thicker, heavier blended nutritional formulas.
But the absolute requirement for a G-tube is that the patient must have normal gastric emptying.
Right. The stomach has to be able to actually process that volume and move it along.
When it can't, the clinical approach has to pivot. If you have severe delayed gastric emptying, formula just pools in the stomach.
You're getting a dangerous volume buildup.
Exactly. Or if they have severe pancreatitis and you want to avoid stimulating the stomach entirely.
But the really critical red flag is a high risk of regurgitation and aspiration.
Yeah, that's the big one.
If a neurologically compromised patient throws up a large volume of formula, they can easily inhale that fluid directly into their lungs.
Triggering aspiration pneumonia, which is life-threatening.
So to neutralize that risk, they bypass the stomach entirely and feed directly into the jejunum, the middle section of the small intestine, using a J-tube.
And the anatomy changes everything here. The small intestine is incredibly narrow and delicate compared to the stomach.
So J-tubes have to be significantly smaller, usually 5 to 16 French. A 5 French tube is essentially the thickness of a piece of spaghetti.
It's a very tight fit,
Yeah.
which heavily restricts the type of formula you can use. You're limited to very thin, highly processed liquids so the tube doesn't clog.
And what's amazing is when a patient has compounding issues, say they have a massive tumor in their upper digestive tract or a motility disorder where their stomach just doesn't empty.
What's fascinating here is how medical engineers solve those compounding issues using combination tubes.
Right, because even if you can't feed into the stomach lining is still actively producing a high volume of digestive juices.
And because those juices can't empty naturally, they build up. The stomach distends, creating severe pressure, nausea, pain.
So the clinical solution is a dual-channel combination tube. It's one physical device doing two entirely different physiological jobs at the exact same time.
The device has two separate lumens, or internal channels, running parallel inside the main casing.
The primary channel goes entirely through the stomach and deep into the small intestine to deliver the nutrition.
While the secondary channel terminates earlier, it stays right inside the stomach cavity.
And that second port is used strictly for decompression, just continuously draining away those pooled gastric juices and venting trapped air.
It's an incredibly elegant mechanical solution. And the clinical texts outline another variation that takes this a step further. The PEJ.
The percutaneous endoscopic jejunostomy.
Yeah. Often, a patient already has a standard PEG tube in their stomach. Months go by, their condition deteriorates, and suddenly the stomach can't tolerate feedings anymore.
They urgently need to be fed into the jejunum.
But instead of subjecting a fragile patient to a whole new abdominal surgery, the medical team uses the artificial doorway that's already there.
They take a really long, narrow PEJ tube and thread it directly through the center of the existing PEG tube.
It is literally a tube through a tube configuration.
The smaller inner tube uses the hollow casing of the larger outer tube as a tunnel, passing completely through the stomach cavity and down through the pyloric sphincter,
sparing them another surgical wound. But the trade-off falls squarely on the nursing staff and the caregivers.
The bedside management of a PEJ requires intense vigilance.
Because you now have two functional ports right next to each other. The caregiver has to be absolutely certain which port leads to the stomach and which one leads to the intestine.
Right, because if you push a high-volume feeding formula into the wrong port, a stomach port, it could rapidly distend the stomach and trigger a catastrophic aspiration event.
Which is terrifying.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the internal plumbing is only half the battle. The external care, the daily reality of managing this artificial stoma, is governed by a super regimented timeline.
A timeline of wound healing.
Exactly. When the surgeon creates that new stoma, the body is suddenly dealing with a deep traumatic puncture wound.
So for the first 48 to 72 hours, the clinical standard is uncompromising. It is treated as a highly vulnerable surgical wound.
Absolute sterile technique for any dressing changes.
Because the risk of introducing a pathogen straight into the sterile abdominal cavity is at its peak. The body hasn't had time to build a protective tunnel yet.
But the adaptive nature of our biology is remarkable. Once you pass that 72-hour window, assuming no signs of infection, the protocol flips.
You transition from a strict sterile environment to just simple clean technique.
Warm soap and water. And actually, the recommended practice at that stage is to leave the stoma entirely open to the air to promote healing.
The skin surface heals quickly, but the internal structural formation is a much slower process. Which brings us to the bolster.
That small plastic disc or crossbar sitting on the outside of the abdomen.
Right. For the first 4 weeks after surgery, that external bolster must remain tightly secured against the patient's skin.
And that tightness is structurally necessary. The internal bumper inside the stomach and the external bolster are acting as scaffolding.
Applying gentle compression to sandwich the stomach wall directly against the interior abdominal wall.
Ensuring the body heals those two layers together into a fully sealed permanent tract. You absolutely do not loosen it during those first 4 weeks.
But the moment you hit that 4 week mark and the tract is mature, the protocol flips entirely again.
Keeping it tight becomes actively dangerous. The guidelines mandate that the bolster must be loosened. It has to sit about 0.5 to 1 centimeter, like a quarter to a half of an inch away from the skin.
Failing to do that leads to an MDRPI, a medical device-related pressure injury.
Because if you leave a hard plastic disc compressed tightly against the abdomen, it cuts off vital blood flow to the capillary beds.
The tissue breaks down, ulcerates, undergoes necrosis. The very device nourishing the patient can cause a massive external wound.
And this ties into a really common mistake. Imagine caring for a loved one with a new feeding tube. Your natural instinct is to slide some soft gauze under that hard plastic disc to make them more comfortable.
But the clinical rules dictate a hard stop on that practice. You must never place drain gauze underneath the external bolster.
Because doing that artificially changes the geometry of the device. You're pushing the external disc further outward,
which pulls the internal bumper tighter against the delicate inner lining of the stomach,
dramatically increasing the internal tension. That constant pulling causes severe gastric tissue erosion. You can cause internal bleeding just by trying to cushion the outside.
It's a critical nursing rule. And speaking of the outside, let's talk about the clinical images from our source stack. They capture something that routinely panics families.
Oh, yes. The first image shows the skin right around a stomatocyte, and there is this ring of highly moist, bright, beefy red tissue overgrowing the area.
If you don't have clinical training, you look at that raw red growth and immediately assume it's a massive, raging infection.
It looks very angry, right? But the medical texts are clear. This beefy red presentation is actually healthy, highly vascular granulation tissue.
It is visible evidence of the body's natural healing cascade. It's aggressively generating new blood vessels to close the perceived wound.
It's an expected biological response, not a bacterial infection. But it still requires management.
Right, because granulation tissue is exceptionally moist. If it overgrows unchecked, it alters the microclimate of the skin.
That excess moisture will macerate and break down the healthy abdominal tissue around it.
And part of managing that whole area comes down to simple physics. How the tubing is secured.
The taking protocol. The texts say you have to leave a defined slack loop in the tubing right at the exit site.
That slack loop acts as a vital shock absorber.
Because if you take the tube down flat and taut, any movement rolling over, sitting up, even just coughing transfers kinetic energy directly to the stoma.
That constant repetitive tension stretches and widens the artificial opening. And once it widens beyond the diameter of the tube, the seal is broken.
Gastric juices start leaking out and pooling on the skin. And gastric juices have a very high concentration of hydrochloric acid.
Designed to break down dense proteins.
So when it sits on delicate skin, it rapidly causes severe chemical excoriation. It basically burns the top layers of the skin in hours.
This constant battle against physics and chemistry is exactly why they developed a totally different class of devices.
The low-profile devices, often called buttons in the clinical setting.
Like the MIC key device, shown in our second image, it represents a massive leap in quality of life.
It's a stark departure from the traditional dangling tube. It's this compact, flexible silicone port that sits completely flush against the abdomen.
It looks like a sleek piece of hardware, almost like a charging port integrated into the body.
And the texts highlight why this is transformative, especially in pediatric care or for adults with cognitive decline.
A traditional dangling tube is a huge snag hazard. It catches on clothes, doorknobs.
And for a curious toddler, the temptation to just grab it and pull is overwhelming. The flush design of the button completely eliminates that physical hazard.
And the psychological impact is profound. Beyond being cosmetically discreet, which improves body image, it offers unparalleled freedom.
Water immersion is a great example. With a traditional tube, you have to be highly cautious around water to avoid contaminating the stoma.
But a child with a skin-level button can be fully immersed. They can take a normal bath.
Jump into a swimming pool with their friends. It completely normalizes their interaction with the world.
But the button does introduce its own unique mechanical quirks.
Because the core feature is this highly sensitive one-way anti-reflux valve right at the skin surface.
Which is brilliant because it perfectly seals the stomach, preventing acidic leaks without needing bulky external clamps.
But because it's a strict one-way inward valve, air cannot escape.
The patient has a permanently locked front door.
So when they swallow air or as metabolic gases build up during digestion, that air is trapped.
The natural release mechanism, burping up the esophagus, is usually bypassed or neurologically compromised in these patients.
Meaning the caregiver literally has to perform manual burping of the device.
You have to physically attach a specialized decompression extension tube to override the valve, just to vent the gas and relieve the gastric distension.
And because feedings require attaching an external extension tube into the locking mechanism, an active toddler can easily twist and disconnect it mid-feed.
Formula everywhere. It demands constant vigilance.
Speaking of vigilance, our sources detail a scenario that really highlights the sheer mechanical force of the human body.
Oh, the Foley catheter situation.
Yes. In some settings, a standard Foley catheter is repurposed as a gastrostomy tube. It has a small inflatable water balloon at the internal tip to stop it from sliding out.
That inflated balloon rests flush against the interior gastric wall. But to keep it there, the caregiver has to maintain a very slight, constant external tension on the tube.
anchoring it against the outside of the abdomen. If that external tension is lost, it becomes an immediate mechanical emergency.
Because the stomach isn't just a static bag. It's a highly active muscular organ relying on peristalsis.
Those strong wave-like contractions designed to crush food.
If the external tension is lost, the tube slips inward. The stomach's peristaltic waves blindly grab onto that inflated balloon and pull it deeper.
Actively migrating the balloon right down to the pyloric sphincter, the exit door into the small intestine.
The balloon wedges tightly into that sphincter, acting as a complete mechanical cork, totally occluding the stomach outlet.
Creating a rapid medical crisis because the stomach keeps producing fluid with nowhere to empty it.
This is exactly why nursing protocols dictate the visible length of the tube protruding from the body must be meticulously measured every single shift.
They draw a physical reference mark on the tube exactly at skin level. If a nurse sees that mark has moved even slightly inward, they know the tube is migrating.
And a pyloric occlusion is imminent.
That microscopic vigilance is amplified even further at the extreme end of the feeding tube spectrum, the nasoduodenal and nasojejunal tubes.
Heavily utilized in pediatric intensive care units.
These deep placement tubes are for critically ill children facing the absolute highest risk of aspiration. Traumatic brain injuries, kids on mechanical ventilators.
You cannot risk a fraction of a milliliter of formula entering their lungs.
So a specialist threads this incredibly long microscopic tube down the nasal cavity, entirely through the stomach, past the pyloric sphincter, and deep into the small intestine.
The internal diameter is so incredibly small that they clog constantly.
Institutional protocols demand they be aggressively flushed with sterile water every 4 hours around the clock.
Plus flushing before and after any medication. And because the tip is deep in the sensitive small intestine, bolus feeding is strictly contraindicated.
Right. Bolus feeding, delivering a large volume of formula all at once like a normal meal. The stomach handles that bulk volume fine, but the small intestine absolutely cannot.
Delivering a bolus into the jejunum overwhelms it, causing severe distension, cramping, and osmotic diarrhea.
So they rely entirely on continuous mechanical feeding pumps, a slow, calibrated microscopic drip 24 hours a day.
And the monitoring parameters are razor sharp. The texts explicitly state that if a child with a post-pyloric tube suddenly vomits, it is an absolute red flag.
You halt the feeding pump immediately because the small intestine does not vomit.
Vomiting strongly indicates the tip of the tube has displaced. It's coiled backward through the sphincter and up into the stomach.
Completely defeating the protective purpose of the placement. So what does this all mean? When we synthesize all these protocols and clinical realities,
bypassing the mouth is never a simple plug-and-play scenario.
It's a meticulous 24-hour-a-day high-wire act, balancing mechanical pressure to prevent tissue necrosis from a bolster.
Precise anatomical awareness to stop a balloon from corking the pyloric sphincter.
Managing the messy reality of manually burping a mechanical valve on a toddler. And underpinning all of it are those uncompromising hygiene protocols.
The 4 moments for hand hygiene, catching a 6-millimeter tube migration before it becomes a crisis.
It completely recontextualizes how delicate and demanding this artificial lifeline is.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, though, looking beyond the incredible engineering, it raises a profound question about the fundamental human experience. Biologically, these tubes are miraculous. They deliver the exact nutrients, hydration, and calories a body needs to survive and grow.
The mechanical requirements are perfectly met.
But human eating is not just a transfer of fuel. It is fundamentally a sensory, communal, and psychological experience.
We structure our whole social lives and cultural identities around tasting, chewing, and sharing meals.
When a patient has to completely bypass the mouth and throat, abandoning the act of tasting for months or years, the physical body is sustained.
But you have to ask, what does that total absence of sensory input do to a patient's psychological relationship with food?
When you never experience the tactile sensation of a warm meal filling your stomach, the satisfaction of chewing.
Or those complex flavor profiles that trigger deep memories.
How does the brain rewire its understanding of hunger and satiety? Medical engineering has brilliantly solved keeping the body alive.
But navigating that profound psychological void left by the absence of eating, that is an entirely different frontier of patient care.
It's a staggering reality to consider.
The technology fulfills the vital needs, but the mind still has to reconcile a deeply ingrained human experience that just no longer exists.
It really gives you a lot to think about.
It does. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We really hope you are walking away with a profoundly expanded appreciation for the complex, highly engineered world of medical nutrition.
The daily vigilance required to maintain it.
And the incredible resilience of the human body. Until next time, stay curious.